Pete Rose logged more hits in baseball history than anyone else. No one has come close to breaking his record. But he was also at the center of one of the game's biggest scandals, a scandal that changed baseball forever. In the new book, Charlie Hustle, New York Times bestselling author Keith O'Brien chronicles Pete Rose's spectacular rise and fall. Drawing on firsthand interviews with Rose himself and his associates, this is Pete Rose as we've never seen him before. By Charlie Hustle, available wherever books are sold.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Hiring can be pretty time-consuming. You post a job to several online job boards only to get tons of the wrong resumes. Then you have to sort through all of those resumes just to find a few people with the right skills and experience. Those job sites that overwhelm you with the wrong resumes, they're not smart. That's why you should do the smart thing and go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the right skills, education, and experience, and actively invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. It's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. If you love this show, show your support to it and ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. M-U-R-D-E-R. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. On July 27, 1981, 6-year-old Adam Walsh was abducted from the Hollywood Mall in Hollywood, Florida, and later found decapitated. The horror of the event would change America forever and bring about much-needed changes to child protection and safety laws. Willis Morgan was at the Hollywood Mall on the same day. It was there he had an unnerving encounter with serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer, known as the Milwaukee Cannibal, just before Adam went missing. However, his witness statements about Dahmer were rejected by police, and he watched in frustration as they investigated and convicted Otis Toole, knowing they had the wrong man. Frustrated witness details the various eyewitness accounts of the events of that fateful day in the mall and major flaws in the police investigation in an attempt to right a wrong that continues to haunt him. This is the account of Adam Walsh's abduction and my attempt stretching across decades to find justice for him, Morgan writes. As much as this book is a case for Jeffrey Dahmer being Adam's murderer, it is equally a study of how the Hollywood Police Department, HPD, conducted the homicide investigation. Morgan has left no stone unturned in his quest for truth, and Frustrated Witness includes an incredible array of evidence he gathered, piece by painstaking piece, to prove Dahmer committed the murder of Adam Walsh. This includes statements of witnesses he tracked down, crime scenes he uncovered, police investigative reports he researched, an analysis of suspect composites, and even the sordid details of Dahmer's murky past before he came to be known as America's most notorious serial killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is Frustrated Witness, the complete story of the Adam Walsh case and police misconduct. With my special guest, journalist and author, Willis Morgan. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Willis Morgan.
Well, thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much. Incredible book. I think it's safe to say that this is going to change people's minds in a lot of ways about this case, the Adam Walsh case, and about Jeffrey Dahmer as well. Tell us about who you were, what you were doing, what was your position July 27th, 1981? What were you doing at that time at the Miami Herald press room? Tell us a little bit about what position you were in at that time before we talk about July 27th, 1981 and your trip to Hollywood Mall.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm originally from New York, and I moved down to South Florida after I got out of the Air Force following my parents who down here. They had moved while I was in the Air Force. So I came down in 1972 to Miami, and I took a job with the Miami Herald, working as a trainee in the press room, in the printing department. So I was there since 1972. And about 4 years after I was there, I became the training supervisor. And so I had a job as the supervisor in 1981. We were working a four-day work week, 10 hours a day, 40 hours a week. So my days off were Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. So Monday was my slowest day off, or my middle day off, I should say. So I decided on Monday, July 27th, 1981, to go to the Hollywood Mall because I wanted to get lunch there at the German Deli. But before I went down to the deli, I stopped in Walden's bookstore, browsed around, didn't buy anything, though, and I headed down to the deli. But since Radio Shack was on the same side of the mall that I was on, I decided to stop into Radio Shack. And it was in Radio Shack that I had this encounter that would become something that would change my life and become a, you know, a part of me forever, because that encounter was so bizarre and so strange that I actually followed this guy after he left thinking that somebody else was going to be in trouble. And I actually watched him walk through the mall, turn into Sears, go to the backside, west side of Sears, and then turn to the right and then into the toy department. I stood there for a minute wondering what this guy was doing. He never came back out. I'm thinking, well, maybe he's playing the video game. So I just turned around and left. And ever since that day, I've regretted that. In fact, I've regretted it so much that a week later, or even less than a week, I don't remember, it was a few days at least later, that I joined one of the search teams. And we were searching people's backyards, garbage cans, everything, looking for anything that could have belonged to Adam. They made a list and handed it out to everybody and explained what Adam was wearing and to keep an eye out if we see anything like that. But we never found anything. So
take us back to July 27th, though, 1981.
Okay.
After you see him go to the toy department, again, you've had this encounter with a strange man, and we didn't talk about what he actually says to you. Tell us what he says to you and why you were alarmed, and how good a look do you get at this person?
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't just what he said. It was his whole demeanor, his posture, you know, his persona, you know, everything about him. He was so disheveled, and he had this dead, dull, blank look in his eyes as he was smiling. I mean, it was just very strange. And what happened was I walked into Radio Shack, and I started walking to the right side of this aisle that ran down the middle of the store. And there was a table right at the front of that aisle, and it had a sign saying Red Tag Sale. And there were a lot of items on the table, and I picked something up that caught my eye, and I was looking at it. And that's when I noticed this guy standing at the entrance to Radio Shack. And in my peripheral vision, so I look up, and you see this young, disheveled man standing there. And he was smiling at me, like I said, with his dead, dull look in his eyes, but yet trying to be friendly. And he says to me, "Hi there. Nice day, isn't it?" And I'm thinking, oh, boy, this guy wants a conversation or something, you know. So I didn't answer him, thinking that once you say something, that initiates more conversation. So I just looked back to the table of the item that I was looking at. But instead of leaving, he came into the Radio Shack and came right up to me. And he repeated again, standing arm's length from me in a very loud tone, the same thing. "Hi there. Nice day, isn't it?" And it was at that point that I didn't answer again that things became very, very strange and very tense, like I said, because he was intent on having a conversation with me, and I wouldn't respond. And just to keep it short, you know, like I said, that whole entire encounter lasted maybe for 2-3 minutes that he actually stood over me, staring at me while I'm not responding. And so finally, he turned around and just stomped out of the Radio Shack. And my first feelings were relief that he left. But then I'm thinking, he's going to go up to somebody else and somebody's going to need some help. This guy is very, very dangerous. I mean, this is the feeling I had, just that look about him. And so I went to the Radio Shack entrance and I looked down the mall, the main hallway. And at first I didn't see him, but then I saw he crossed over to the other side and he was just meandering real slow deep into the mall. So I was watching him. And I watched him walk to the Sears entrance, in the interior entrance of the mall, and then he turned right into Sears. And he, like I said, he walked all the way to the Radio Shack, to the toy department, I'm sorry, and I was keeping an eye on him the whole time. But I turned around and left. And when I went home that very same evening, I happened to be in the kitchen, and I had a TV on in the living room, and I hear on the local news they were talking about a young boy that went missing. And all of a sudden they said Hollywood Mall, the time, the location, the Sears toy department. Then right away I'm thinking, that guy, it was that guy, he did it. Because everything matched. The time, this was around noon, 12:30. And I knew it had to be that guy. Just didn't know his name. I didn't know who that guy was. He never said his name. So anyway, that was Monday. Tuesday, I told a couple friends, my neighbor. They encouraged me to go to the police, but I didn't go. But on Thursday, or Wednesday, I should say, when I went back to work Wednesday night, I was telling coworkers about this. And it was some coworkers that encouraged me to go to the police, and that's when I finally decided I will go. And so I went there Thursday first thing in the morning, and I tried to tell them about the encounter I had in the Radio Shack the same day. And the detective that I spoke to was very dismissive. He did not, very condescending as well, very arrogant, dismissive, and condescending. That was the impression I got. In fact, the actual impression I was thinking at the time was that he must have been on light duty and they just stuck him on his desk in the main lobby because they had a desk set up specially just for this case.
Right.
And I was trying to tell him what happened, but he only wanted to know if I had a receipt to prove I was there and if I had seen the vehicle and the tag number. And I tried to explain to him this was inside the mall, never went outside. So in short, he basically took my name, phone number, and said if they need me, they'll get back to me. But they never got back to me. Nobody's ever called me, nothing. And then a few days later, I started seeing composites showing up in the newspapers. And some of those composites were the spitting image of this guy that I had this encounter with. And when I say spitting image, to me they were the spitting image, but close enough that I knew that we were talking about the same guy. Whoever made those composites saw the same person that I saw, that I had that encounter with. Okay. So my thinking was, well, at least they have their composite. There's nothing more I can do, so I just let it go. I never really did much, but I did keep following the story in the newspaper. And I said, I did join one of the search teams, and so I was keeping up with this. And then I started reading articles about how they were going after John Walsh's house guest, because he had this
right.
house guest living in his house. His name was James Campbell. And while John Walsh was out to work, apparently what I was reading in the papers there was that James was having an affair with Will Bay. I mean, I didn't read this then. That part wasn't in the paper. But later on when I got the case files, I found out. But anyways, James Campbell was living with John Walsh, and he apparently was having an affair with Revay, and he proposed marriage to her, and she turned him down because she had a son with John. So at the time, the police were thinking they had their motive and their suspect, because they were thinking, you get rid of the kid and you get the wife. And on that day, they were saying, because this was in the paper at the time, that John Walsh and James Campbell are the only two people that knew Revay was going to that mall. So they really concentrated on James Campbell. In the meantime, while they were concentrating on him, there were other incidents that mirrored the Hollywood Mall abduction. Witnesses from all over South Florida were calling the Hollywood Police Department, as well as police chiefs from these other cities. South Beach, Deerfield, Riviera Beach, which is north of West Palm Beach, Plantation, and Composites Match, the Hollywood Mall. But they were dismissing all these other witnesses. They were dismissing even the police chiefs that were calling them, and even making up their own police reports and hand-delivering them to the Hollywood Police Department. They were dismissing everything. They were so convinced, the lead detective, Jack Hoffman, was so convinced that James Campbell was a suspect that he dismissed the blue van, even though all these other locations had a blue van. A white suspect that was around 6 feet tall, and like I say, some of the composites were the spitting image of the Hollywood Mall composite. But according to the lead detective, Jack Hoffman, back then, there's an article in the defunct Hollywood Sun Sentinel that said that the Hollywood Police Department thought they had their biggest lead in the case when there was an attempted abduction in the Riviera Twin City Mall, because the composites matched. And there was a blue van involved, and like I said, everything matched. But the problem is, those composites, even though they matched the composites from the Hollywood Mall, none of them matched James Campbell. So instead of dismissing James Campbell, they dismissed all the witnesses from the Riviera Beach incident and the Hollywood Mall.
Amazing.
And he also dismissed the blue van. So he never told anybody about dismissing the blue van, so the BOLO was still passed out to hundreds of police cars, and they had them attached to the inside of their car, and they were looking for blue vans everywhere, stopping hundreds and hundreds of them. They say there was like over 7,000 blue vans that were searched at that time. It was like one of the biggest vehicle searches in the history of the state of Florida. In fact, if you had a blue van and you made a U-turn, the police considered you trying to get away, and they would pull you over and give you extra scrutiny. If you had a blue van and you tried to sell it or you sold it, they would consider you trying to get rid of evidence, and then they would really give you more scrutiny as well as that vehicle. They were going to junkyards looking for blue vans and doing searches everywhere. But all while Jack Hoffman had dismissed the blue van.
Tell us about your second encounter with this mystery man at Hollywood Mall.
Yes.
3 weeks
yes,
later.
I know. I sometimes I don't like talking about the second encounter because this sounds so odd, but it's the truth.
Sure.
The reason is the odds of meeting the same suspect twice, you know, seems like it's like the odds are very, very, very slim. But about 3 weeks later, after that first encounter, I work for a newspaper. So, you know, the Miami Herald is a morning newspaper, so we work on the graveyard shift, basically, the late shift, you know, producing the paper. So I would get off of work sometimes around 5 o'clock. We didn't really have time clocks, so whenever we finished is when we got off. And I live in the first town over the county line north of Miami, which is about 18 miles north of where I worked. So by the time I get home, it's close to 5:30 because there's no traffic at that time of the morning. And I was pulling onto my street that I live on, which was Bedford Avenue. It's a dead-end street. And I noticed, before I even turned onto the street, that there was this vehicle behind me. I didn't pay attention, but then when I made a right, the vehicle made a right. I made a left, the vehicle made a left. And as I turned onto Bedford Avenue, the vehicle turned onto the same street. And I'm thinking, I didn't really think anything of it, because I'm thinking this is the time of the morning where they do the home deliveries. And they were just doing home deliveries. So I didn't pay attention until I pulled up in front of my house. And I had my boat in the driveway, so I parallel parked on the street. And the van, the blue van, pulled alongside my car. I had a 77 Pontiac Catalina. And it pulled up alongside. The guy rolls his window down as I'm getting out of my car. And he says to me, "Hey, do you have insurance?" And I didn't answer him. He says, "You know, you almost hit me. I need to see your insurance." So I turned to him and I said, "Almost doesn't count." And I went inside. I thought that was kind of strange. You know, why does he need insurance? I didn't hit him. So I went inside.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in the bedroom taking my things out of my pocket. Then I decided, I don't know, that was just kind of too strange. So I decided, let me go to the kitchen and look out the window and see what this guy's doing, if he's still here or not. I look out the window, and the van's still there. And I look, and I see the guy is not in his van. And I see him sitting on the hood of my neighbor's car, which was also parallel parked on the street in front of a house. He was sitting on the hood, which was facing the same direction as my car, and he was just staring at my car. And so I started to get a knife out of the kitchen drawer. I was going to go back outside, but I wanted to, you know, be armed with something. Then I'm thinking, no, that's not a good idea. Let me go get my gun. So I go into the bedroom. I get my Beretta and my .38 Smith & Wesson. I check, make sure it's loaded, because a lot of times I don't keep the first chamber loaded. I wanted to make sure I had it on a chamber that was ready to go. And I go outside, but he was gone. And it was at that time it took me a while to realize that's the same guy from the mall. Because I wasn't paying attention to him, I was trying to ignore him. So I didn't put it together until I got my gun and went outside, and I'm thinking, that's the guy. And so I immediately ran back inside, got my car keys, and I ran back outside, got my car, and of course I had my gun with me, so that helps. And I started searching everywhere for him, and I couldn't find him. He just disappeared into the streets. I wouldn't know till they released the case files that I was looking through the files, and I saw just a block from my house where another witness called in that blue van and said that the van and the guy matched the composites from the Hollywood Mall. So I'm thinking, that he was there. That has to be this guy. You know, more than that, there's nothing to prove that it was him, but I'm 100% certain. And when I see the mugshot of Jeffrey Dahmer that was taken just 2 months after Adam's abduction, because when Dahmer was fired from his job, he was working down here at a sub shop. He got fired in late September and went back to Ohio. On October 7th, he got arrested for disorderly conduct. And had a mugshot taken, and that mugshot is the closest similarity to the person that was in the Hollywood Mall, because his hair is still long, he's still got his Florida tan, and it looks just like the guy that was sitting on my neighbor's car and that I encountered in the Radio Shack, and I knew that was him. That's the guy. It was Jeffrey Dahmer. There's no question. In fact, I knew it even before I saw that photo. I knew the day Jeffrey Dahmer was, there was an article in the paper, and we were doing paper checks in 1991, and there was a story, it was on page 8A, of this guy that was arrested in Milwaukee for doing some pretty horrendous things in his apartment up there, and I didn't even know at that time that this guy was ever in Florida. This was just a story about Milwaukee, but when I got to page 8A, and I saw this little mugshot, I recognized the guy instantaneously. And I started freaking out. I started saying, hey, this is the guy. This is the guy I saw on the mall that day. You know? And so anyway, I took that paper, and since I worked for a newspaper, I called what we call the library. The library is a storage room, actually, because back in those days they didn't have computers, so they stored hard copies of all the Miami Herald papers. And they would do research. But if you wanted research done, you had to have a pretty close idea of a date, which I did, July 27th, 1981. Because remember, this is 1991, 10 years later, almost to the week. I called the library up and I asked them, I said, do you remember the composite that ran in the paper of the from the Adam Walsh abduction? And they said, yes, of course. And I said, it was July 27th, 1981. A few days after that, the composite started showing. Can you send me the composite? And they did. What I didn't realize until 2008 when they closed the case, they sent me the wrong composite. They sent me one from one of those other incidents and that mirrored the Hollywood Mall. And I took it back to the police department with the newspaper, the mugshot from the paper, and I showed it to them. I said, look, this is the guy that I saw in the mall. The first thing they want to know is, well, what are you doing coming in now? How come you didn't come in 1981? And I said, but I did come in 81. They had no clue that I was ever there. You know, that detective that I talked at the front desk actually was a police officer in full uniform that I talked to. Apparently he didn't pass his notes on. So nobody knew anything that I was there. But their jaws dropped when I showed them the mugshot, because there was a spitting image. And you've seen it, Dan, the mugshot as well as the composite. They are a perfect match. And they knew, Detective Jack Hoffman, who was still on the case, knew that that mugshot was from the Twin City Mall that he dismissed, as well as all these other incidents that he kept dismissing. So what did he do? He goes into full cover-up mode, and it was about that time when all the artist tool evidence grew legs and walked off. You know, even the Hollywood Police Department says evidence was lost.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Well, let's talk about that artist. Let's talk about...
Evidence doesn't get lost, is what I was going to say. I believe it was expunged. And who had the most to lose was Jack Hoffman.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the artist tool, what he said, because we glossed over that. He confessed in 1983. To be able to explain Jack Hoffman and everyone else's behavior afterward at Hollywood Police Department, let's talk about what Otis Toole said and why. How was he in a situation to say anything to these investigators about Adam Walsh?
Right.
Well, as you do in the book, tell us about that.
Right. Otis Toole injected himself not only into the Adam Walsh case, but into literally hundreds of cases throughout the United States. And police departments all over the country were coming down to interview him. This is in Jacksonville where he was, at the Duval County Jail, to interview him so they can close cases in their cities. And many cases were closed all over the country until police started realizing that the timelines were clashing. You can't be on both East Coast and West Coast at the same time committing murders. So one by one, they had to reopen their cases and dismiss Otis Toole as nothing but a tall tale and a liar and a storyteller. That's every police department except for one. That's the Hollywood Police Department. They still kept going after him for months afterwards. And in the beginning, he was getting his stories so wrong. He claimed it was in January. He claimed that, everything, the description of Adam, he got wrong. What Adam was wearing, he got wrong. He got everything wrong until about the fourth interview, because these cops, these detectives, kept feeding them information unwittingly. They would show him crime scene photos of where the severed head was found, so he could recollect his memory, you know, of what happened. And so they were feeding him this information. In fact, by the fourth interview, Jack Hoffman said to Otis Toole, he says, Otis, because Otis Toole claimed when he was getting the information wrong that it was because he was intoxicated. So by the fourth interview, he started getting the answers all correct to conform what the detectives wanted the answers to be. And Jack Hoffman says to him, he says, Otis, are you sure you were intoxicated? Because you're getting all the answers right now. After he gave him the answers.
Sure.
And even the Hollywood Police Department, though, after about 4 months, dismissed Otis Toole. So Otis Toole was totally dismissed. In fact, I called one of the lead detectives, the second lead detective, Ron Hickman, and I talked to him. And this is after they closed the case. And I told him about the police chief closing the case. At first, he had no clue who I was. You know, he said he's been on the case since its inception. He's never heard of me.
Right.
And then he started saying, oh, yes, I do remember you now, because I remember reading about a lawsuit, you know, because I filed lawsuits against the Hollywood Police Department and one of the detectives over there named Joe Matthews, as well as a lawsuit against the state attorney's office, because we're all covering up facts in the case. And so he remembered the lawsuit, and I asked him, I said, listen, Ron, you know, when the Hollywood police chief closed the case, in his statement, he said, police, detectives, investigators, past and present, all believed Otis Toole was the suspect. And he goes to me, he goes, well, they know I don't. And so he said that to me personally. But then when you go back in the case files and read all their statements, every one of them dismiss Otis Toole. Otis Toole was totally dismissed until Joe Matthews decided to make Otis Toole the suspect, because Joe Matthews has always wanted Otis Toole to be the suspect.
You talk about Joe Matthews also wanting to be an author. Now, tell us a little bit about the book and if that had any relation to or any motivation for his Otis Toole as his main suspect for the Adam Walsh abduction.
Right. Listen, a couple years before they closed the Adam Walsh case in 2008, Revay and John Walsh contacted Joe Matthews because even though John Walsh wrote his book, Tears of Rage, the title being The Rage Over the Hollywood police departments, the way they were handling the investigation of his son. In fact, in his book, he calls all of them, you know, the biggest bunch of bumbling, stumbling idiots since the Keystone Cops. But now, all of a sudden, let me back up a little bit. In 1987, February 8th, I believe it was, John Walsh was chosen to host America's Most Wanted. Well, one of these detectives, his name was Joe Matthews, called John Walsh and befriended him. And this is the one that, you know, is putting all his money on Otis Toole, even though everyone else has dismissed Otis Toole. So he befriended John Walsh, and John Walsh hired this detective as a senior lead investigator on America's Most Wanted. So John Walsh had one of these detectives in his midst for years feeding false information about his own son's abduction. And the reason John Walsh had faith in this guy is because Joe Matthews was also a polygraph examiner. He had his own business called the Southern Institute of Polygraph. And the Hollywood Police Department hired his company to do the polygraphs of James Campbell and John Walsh, and he dismissed them both. So John Walsh felt gratitude, apparently. You know, that's my opinion. But whatever, John Walsh did hire him, and he had him right in his midst for years on America's Most Wanted. So around 2006, I would say, Revere wanted to get the case finally closed. She wanted closure. So John went and called Joe Matthews and asked him if he would do an independent investigation, and he did. So he came up with this manuscript that he named after himself called the Matthews Report. In that report, which is a 400-page report, he totally pins Adam's murder on Otis Toole. And he comes to his conclusion without calling not one witness. Not one witness that was at the Hollywood Mall, and believe me, there were well over a dozen. Not one witness from any of the other incidents. The only people that I never read the report, because he refuses to show it to anybody now. But his book that he wrote, that he had a co-author write for him, was based on the manuscript. He gave that manuscript to a co-author and said, hey, can you format this into a book? And that book is called Bringing Adam Home. So in that book, he never mentions any of the witnesses, and except for one. But then he says that one witness called him and said that he was kicked out of the store with Adam. But all of that is fake, too, because I found that witness's sister, and she was there with him, and she denies that, and he's passed away, so he can't speak for himself. But anyway, the only witnesses that Matthews uses in that book are witnesses like Otis Toole's cellmates and people that were in prison with him who would say things like, yeah, everybody in prison knows Otis Toole did it, things like that. I mean, no evidence whatsoever. And one of his biggest pieces of evidence that he uses is his Shroud of Turin photo that he claims he found, which would, you know, anybody could find. I got copies of them. Anybody can get copies. They're public information, you know. And he claims that they were hidden. And when he first looked at this one photo, his eyes popped out of his head because he saw Adam. Well, I've got the same role, and they're in my book. They're on my website if anybody doesn't want to buy the book, or you can just go to frustratedwitness.com, or you can go to justiceforadam.com. I have two websites. One website, Frustrated Witness, is about the book, Frustrated Witness and the Witnesses and all that. The other book, the website, justiceforadam.com, is where all the case files can be found for free. The state attorney's office case files that I paid over $1,800 to have put on to a CD-ROM set, I posted there. I have the Hollywood police case files, the FBI files for Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee Police Department files for Jeffrey Dahmer. And all of that and much more can be viewed justiceforadam.com, including my lawsuit I have a folder there for my lawsuit. But anyway, Matthew's formatted that into a book called Bringing Adam Home, and that report, the Matthews report, he gave to the Hollywood Police Department, and he bamboozled the chief, the police chief, Chad Wagner, into closing the case based on that manuscript. And in his book, he claims that he wanted that manuscript to be used by police departments throughout the United States as an example of how to solve a cold case, and use it as their guide. But like I said, he never called not one witness, and he never mentions any of them in his book. And about that blue van on page 26 of Bringing Adam Home, this is what Matthews has to say about the blue van that's been spotted. This is the blue van that's been spotted at all three locations that we'll get into relevant to the Adam Walsh case. The Hollywood Mall, where numerous witnesses saw Adam be tossed into a blue van. Okay, the Twin City Mall incident, which isn't, I'm digressing a little, that doesn't have anything to do with the Adam Walsh case. Well, it does, but not according to the police. There was a blue van. But anyways, the Hollywood Mall, the location, the three locations, the second location would be the location where Adam's severed head was found. So let's talk about that for a second. There was a blue van there. What happened was Adam's severed head was found by two fishermen on August 10th, 1981. On August 11th, witnesses started calling the Hollywood Police Department from that location. And one of them was a Publix truck driver, because this was on the Florida Turnpike. There's a small canal there on the side of the turnpike, and these two fishermen were fishing in that canal. It was like a reservoir. And they saw a head floating. At first they thought it was a doll's head, and they rode over to it, and then they realized it was a human, so they rode back to their truck real quick, and they didn't have cell phones back then, so they called on the CB radio to their job. And they had them call the highway patrol, and they went out there. But on August 11th, Dennis Bubb, one of the witnesses that was driving a Publix truck along that route, called the Hollywood Police Department to tell them that he saw a blue van at that site on August 7th, 3 days before it was found, the severed head. And when he told them about the blue van, this is what Dennis told me, how they responded. Okay, this is quotes. Yeah, we already know about the blue van. It has nothing to do with the Adam Walsh case. Now, Dennis right. doesn't know which detective he talked to, the name of the detective, but that's what the detective that he spoke to said to him, and they dismissed him. Now, there was another Publix driver driving 5 minutes behind Dennis. So Dennis called on a CB radio to the Clifton Ramey, who was behind him, and said, hey, there's a blue van on the side of the road. Check it out. So, like I said, what Dennis saw was this man standing on this little footbridge taking something round out of a bucket and throwing it into the water at 12:30 in the morning on August 7th. Now, how would that not pique someone's attention when he tells the Hollywood Police Department that? If I was a homicide sure. detective, I'd jump at that information, especially when there's a blue van involved. Instead of telling them, yeah, we already know about the blue van, it has nothing to do with the Adam Walsh case. You know, what about the something round being taken out of a bucket and tossed into the water? So anyway, Clifton Ramey called also on August 11th because he was, like I said, 5 minutes behind Dennis. And when he passed the blue van, he said in his statement that he saw a man standing by the side sliding door of the blue van, and he could see him fumbling with a bucket. Because the dome light, you know, when the doors are open, the dome lights are on. And sure. the light was on, and he could see this guy fumbling with this bucket. You know, because he was looking to see if the guy was stranded, if he needed any help. And he thought maybe he had an overheated engine, or that's why he was getting water. He didn't really know, but he didn't stop. He didn't do anything, but that was his statement. So you have two witnesses right there, and there were several other witnesses they called. Every one of them were dismissed, all of them. And also, the third location that's relevant with a blue van is where Jeffrey Dahmer worked. Okay? He worked in a sub shop as a busboy. There's numerous witnesses there that confirm they had three vehicles, two white pickup trucks and a blue van. They used them for delivery, the two white pickup trucks. In the wintertime, they used all three vehicles for deliveries. But the van was more expensive on gas, so they only used the two white pickup trucks in the summer because that was the off-season. And keep in mind, this was in the middle of the summer, so they didn't really use the blue van. So they used to just keep it parked on the side of the store, and all the employees could just take it and use it, and that's what they were doing, including Jeffrey Dahmer.
You talk about other witnesses that also saw the van, but you get this information much later when the Adam Walsh case files are open, and then you contact people like Timothy Pottenberg, Vernon Jones, a bunch of people that's, again, confirmed the blue van. And actually, a couple of those witnesses, you talk about Philip Lohr seeing Dahmer carrying Adam out the west exit of the mall that day.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about the FBI's response. You say you tried to...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Contact them. But also the FBI's involvement in this case. Tell us a little bit about that as you do in the book.
Right. Well, you know, there isn't much FBI involvement because the FBI doesn't get involved in cases unless they're involved and invited in. So nobody wanted to invite them in. See, the Hollywood Police Department, Jack Hoffman, the lead investigator in the case, wanted to solve the case on his own. He didn't want any outside help. In John Walsh's book, John Walsh even says that, you know, like the Broward Sheriff's Office offered to help and other police agencies offered assistance, but he turned everybody down. He didn't want any help. He wanted to solve the case all on his own, going after James Campbell. So... he never wanted the FBI to get involved. The FBI can't just come in and get involved in a local case because there was no proof that Adam ever left the state of Florida.
Right.
And only if there's proof that, you know, this was across state lines would the FBI get involved even if they weren't invited. But as long as a homicide is in state, the FBI doesn't get involved. So they never really got involved. But the FBI did have... Jeffrey Dahmer files because they did get involved in that because there was multiple states there that he's been in. The problem with those case files is they're so redacted, every witness is in there, you can't look up any witnesses because they all have their names blotted out. Unlike the Hollywood Police Department, who had the most to lose, see, the FBI had nothing to lose, you know, but the Hollywood Police Department had everything to lose. They redacted nobody's name, and that's how I was able to track down all these witnesses. I did it through joining people search sites, and as well as some of my best searches came from public record sites, like tax offices, you know, Broward County Tax Appraiser's Office, because if you own property, then you would be listed there. So I figured most of these people would have property, and most of them did. And so they were. I was able to locate most of the witnesses. And they told me some you know, pretty Halloween stories. That's how I got Philip Law. You know, I found his name in the case files and looked him up. Jenny Warren, Bill Bowen, all of these witnesses, Janice Santomassino, so many. And we can talk about another witness, Mia Taylor, who was there
right.
with her brother, Joel, not only the day Adam was abducted, but the day before Adam was abducted as well. They
Tell
went in the toy department where their mother was close by shopping. And Jeffrey Dahmer came into the toy department and tried to abduct her brother, Joel. And fortunately for Joel, the security guard came over that day and tried to get everybody to be quiet, and their mother showed up, and so Mia said, "There's Mom," and they ran to their mother. And that's at the same time the security guard shows up and Dahmer takes off. On the way outside, she saw the same disheveled man standing next to and leaning on the side of the blue van. So she's also a blue van witness. The very next day, they were back at the same mall. And her and her brother snuck away from their mom and went to the toy department again. And that same disheveled guy was there. And she says she saw him leaning over Adam and talking to him in a whispered tone. And then she saw him take Adam by the fingertips and walk out with him. And her mother showed up at that very moment. And Joel said, "Mom, I want to stay with my friend," because he was standing there next to Adam. And she said, "No, his dad is here now." So Peggy, Mia's mother, thought Dahmer was his dad. Philip Law, who saw Dahmer dragging Adam out of the store, he started turning around, started walking backwards, watching this, because Adam is screaming, "I don't want to go, you're not my daddy." And he was manhandling this boy. And Philip is thinking, "Boy, his son was that age. He wouldn't handle his son like that." So he started watching this, walking backwards. He was going to the service counter to pay a bill, but while he was in line, he decided to run back outside and check. The blue van, the guy, and Adam were all gone. And when I say the blue van was gone, it's because Philip lost his parking space when he was coming into the store because the blue van was parked in the fire lane blocking the northbound traffic. And so cars had only one lane. They would have to go around it. And what happened was Phil lost the parking space that he had an eye on, and he had to get another one further away. And then on top of that, he had to walk around the blue van when he went into the store, so he was really upset about it. So he remembers the blue van when he went back out, but it was all gone. And Philip was thinking, because he hesitated when he saw this incident, thinking, well, the boy's screaming, "You're not my daddy." He's thinking, well, maybe that's like a stepfather. You know how kids, they don't treat the stepfathers the same way they would a real father, and so sometimes they don't listen to them. So, but then Bill had second thoughts and ran outside. Another witness, Bill Bowen, saw in the parking lot, he saw this guy dragging this boy up, holding him up off the ground by one arm. And then he opens the door and throws him into this van like a sack of potatoes, quote unquote. That's Bill's quote. Like a sack of potatoes. And then the guy jumps in and screeches off. Bill runs over and gets a tag number. Because the way Bill says to this day he still smells the smell of burnt rubber from the vehicle taking off. A couple of days later, he gave the tag number to the police. Nobody knows what happened to that because they don't even know Bill went to them. In fact, Bill called them five times, no less than five times. He kept getting answer machines and leaving messages. Nobody would call him back until about the fifth time he got a live person. And they told Bill that the person he needs to speak to is on vacation and he needs to call back in 2 weeks. Bill tried to explain to them that he's moving to Alabama. That's why he went to the Sears to change his address, his billing address. And so they said, "Okay, we'll contact you." They took his information, but nobody's ever contacted Bill. And then in 1991, as I said, Dahmer's mugshot made the paper because it not only made the Herald, like I said, when I saw it, It made every paper across the United States. Bill saw Dahmer's mugshot in the paper, the Birmingham paper. And he took that paper with the mugshot and on his own came all the way back to Hollywood, Florida, walked into that Hollywood police department and said, "Hey, look, this is the guy I saw at the Hollywood Mall." And they said the same thing to him they said to me. "What are you doing coming in now? How come you didn't come in here in 1981? I said, "What are you talking about? I gave you the tag number." I kept calling five times. I finally got a live person. They told me to call back in 2 weeks. And then they took my name and phone number. Nobody's ever called me. And so, again, you know, they messed that case up so bad that all their dots started coming together in 1991, and they knew how bad they messed up. More miserable than anyone knows. Even John Walsh doesn't realize how, when he called them the biggest bunch of bumbling, stumbling idiots since the Keystone Cops, he don't realize how bad they really were. They were worse than John Walsh could even imagine. So what John Walsh experienced was bad enough for him to call them names like that. If John Walsh really could accept the truth, who knows what he would think of them. Because, you know, John Walsh has accepted Joe Matthews. Like I said, Revay, 2 years before they closed the case, asked Joe Matthews to reinvestigate the case, which he did. And he bamboozled the police chief into closing it, which he did. And Revay is satisfied with that closing. So is John Walsh. You know, it's like the Stockholm Syndrome. You know, when he wrote a book lambasting all these detectives, now that they finally give him his closure, now they're all his, this is John Walsh's own quote, they're his best friends and colleague. So John Walsh doesn't want to hear anything from anybody. In fact, on the 37th anniversary, which was just this last July 27th, Channel 10, down here in South Florida, WPLG, did an anniversary story podcast about the show. They interviewed John Walsh. They interviewed Joe Matthews. They tried to interview the police chief, Chad Wagner, but he said, "Everything I said at the closing is all I've got to say," and he would say no more than that. Other detectives all went into their hiding. They're hiding in their retirement. They don't want to even talk to anybody. She also interviewed me in that show. You could listen to that show. Just the fifth episode. I have it on my website, frustratedwitness.com. You can go listen to it. So, John Walsh,
tell us
in
about
that show, accuses me without mentioning my name of trying to make money off his dead son. But what John doesn't realize, I've spent thousands and thousands of my own dollars doing mitochondrial DNA testing from the murder site where I believe Adam was murdered. So I spent thousands of dollars that I will never make back. I'm not trying to make money. This is not about money. It's about justice, because these cops, they go after the weak, the poor, the downtrodden, who have no family, no education, no money, and nobody comes to their aid, and they pin murders on them to make themselves look good. And that's exactly
let's
what they
talk,
did to Otis Toole.
Let's talk
Go
about
ahead.
The lawsuit. Let's talk about the lawsuit against Joe Matthews. Tell us more about it, your purpose, your intent, what people criticized
right.
you for regarding it.
Yes, of course. Listen, Joe Matthews' manuscript, remember I told you that he gave that manuscript to the police chief, and the police chief wrote a letter and attached it to that manuscript and sent it to the state attorney's office saying, "Hey, read this manuscript because we would like to close the Adam Walsh case and we want your opinion." Well, the district attorney, the assistant district attorney, Charles Morton, he reads it and attaches his own letter back to the police department, the police chief, Chad Wagner, saying, "Yes, this is a great report proving Otis Toole murdered Adam," which means the Hollywood Police Department read that manuscript and they accepted the findings of it. So did the state attorney's office. Now, down here in Florida, we have laws okay, sunshine laws, a lot of sunshine laws that say anything that's used in a murder case or any case has to be part of the case files and subject to public domain and scrutiny by the public. So those files should be part of the record, the Adam Walsh case files. I went to the Hollywood police. I asked them for that manuscript. They don't want to show it to me. I first went to Joe Matthews, asked him for it, because I wanted to, you know, show him what I had and compare it to what he had. Well, obviously, he wouldn't show it to me. I went to the state attorney's office. They wouldn't show it to me. Nobody wants to show me this manuscript that should be part of the case files. Not only that, when the police closed the case on national TV, December 16th, 2008, he praised Joe Matthews, who was sitting there right next to him, and he said that Joe Matthews put that manuscript together proving that it was out of school, which means that he accepted the findings. But all of a sudden, when they wouldn't show it to me, I decided I was going to file a lawsuit to get it, which I did. And all of a sudden now that they're being sued in court, they're saying now that they didn't really use that manuscript. It was nothing more, this is their quote, than a regurgitation, under oath their quote, a regurgitation of everything they already knew, so it wasn't of any use. So they never kept it and they gave it back to Joe. But sunshine laws, there's nothing to do with what your opinion is of it. Whether it's a regurgitation of everything you knew or not. Once you accept it, it has to be part of the case files. That's the law.
Right.
So, Joe Matthews, naturally now, all of a sudden, he's a defendant. I'm the plaintiff. So I filed the lawsuit.
Right.
So he doesn't want to show his manuscript. So he hires this attorney, Tom Panza. Now, this Tom is like one of the biggest lobbyists down here. He donates money to these sheriffs, to the judges, you know, and they have caps on how much you can donate down here. But he gets around the cap. It's $500 by doing what's called as bundling. Bundling is when you donate your $500 many times over by using other names. For instance, he donates his $500, his wife donates $500, his wife's business, Dottie's Delight, donates $500, his six-year-old daughter donates $500, his even younger son donates $500, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how he gets around that, so that when he goes in front of these judges, he gets favorable hearings. And also he gets cases defending these cops on their many, many scandals, especially the Broward Sheriff's Office, that he's defended them many times because of some of their scandals. So naturally, here I am suing these guys, including the state attorney. You know, they say you can't fight City Hall. You're never going to win, and this is the reason. It's called political expediency. These judges will never give an average citizen a fair hearing. So my lawsuit was dismissed. I appealed it, and the appeals court also dismissed it. They rubber stamped the 17th District's decision. The judge even stated, the appeals court judge stated, well, the chief said he didn't use it. I mean, this isn't a judge that should know. That's irrelevant whether he used it or not.
Right.
Because like I said, his opinion of what that report was, they've been wrong so many times. You know, there's a very good chance they could be wrong one more time, that report was useless. You know, and it only became useless after I sued.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So I write about the whole lawsuit. In fact, you can read about the lawsuit at JusticeForAdam.com as well as several chapters in my book. And there was another lawsuit in 1995 by a reporter who also asked for the Adam Walsh case files, and they refused to show it to them. To him back then. And so he filed a lawsuit against the Hollywood Police Department. But he won his lawsuit. In 1996, the court, the same court too, the 17th District Court in Fort Lauderdale, Judge Moe ordered the Hollywood Police Department on to release those files on February 8th, 1996. They were released to the public. But now on that podcast, I see John Walsh claiming that those files were never released. He got them in 2008 when they closed the case, which isn't true. John Walsh gets so much information wrong about his own son's abduction. They've been public information ever since 1996, those files.
How do you explain that he would know that, as you do explain
it? Well,
in the book?
He should, because he was part of the lawsuit. What happened was the Hollywood Police Department, they got rid of Jack Hoffman when that lawsuit was filed. Okay,
right.
So they ushered him off the case and they put a new detective on the case that they claimed was a cold case specialist. Actually, in my book, I call him more of a cold case cover-up specialist. Because when he first took over the case in 1994, he claimed that due to the length of time, it would be impossible to find any new suspects in the Adam Walsh case. But then all of a sudden, when there was a lawsuit, he found suspects because he did not want those files to be released to the public. And so he told the court that, listen, we're still doing an investigation. We have new suspects. We could end up getting a grand jury together to listen to this, but you got to give us more time. And then the judge wasn't going along with that, so he convinced John Walsh to side on the side of the police department. So John Walsh even
right.
sided on the side of the police department, trying to keep those files sealed. So John Walsh knew that those files weren't kept sealed, and the judge ordered them to be released in 1996. John Walsh should know that.
You explain, though, that unfortunately John Walsh was – they did a fantastic job, Hollywood Police Department, in convincing him when they did close his case. They used him. They used his program. They used his sorrow, you say.
Right. They even told John Walsh, please do us a favor. Do yourself a favor. Okay, we do not want these files released because there's information there that will get out into the public and we'll never catch the guy. So John Walsh went along with that. In fact, on America's Most Wanted, he never even did an episode on his own son's abduction until they decided to cancel the show. The last episode was done about his son. They did bring the show back, but when they first
right.
canceled it, they did do an episode on it. And that in that episode, Joe Matthews, remember, at that time, was the lead investigator of America's Most Wanted. So that episode
yeah.
totally pinned Adam's murder on Otis Toole. So John Walsh was convinced. He even said how great that show came out. He was very satisfied with it. But other witnesses, all of a sudden, when that aired, started calling the Hollywood Police Department. Because every time those kinds of shows air, witnesses start calling. And numerous witnesses called. And that's how I got other witnesses, too. Like Janice Attomasino, you know, she saw that show, and she tried to call America's Most Wanted. And she told him, listen, I just watched your show. doing a reenactment with a white Cadillac, and she explained that she was there, and there was a blue van, and she remembers the blue van because the blue van was parked on the in the fire lane, and she was coming around the corner and almost ran rear-ended the blue van because she wasn't expecting a blue van in the northbound lane there, and she almost rear-ended it, so she remembers it. In fact, when she parked and went inside the mall with her two daughters, she was going to report the blue van. But then once she was inside the mall, she forgot about it. But she was in the toy department because a daughter wanted to look at some Barbie dolls. And she saw this disheveled man there, and they locked eyes with Janice. And he just put the fear in her. So she got out of there. And then it was later that, you know, I think days later or the next day she heard about that abduction, and she always knew, you know, that had to be related because the composites were coming out, they were matching. They dismissed her as well. And so she called John Walsh and after they did that show and tried to tell him. He forwarded her name to the Hollywood Police Department and says, hey, call this person and interview her. They never called her, never. There's so many people that he tells them to call, and they never call. And I was going to say that
You talk about being a frustrated witness, and we haven't talked about the extent of your frustration with law enforcement. You talk about Joe Matthews, you talk about Jack Hoffman, but all the successors, everyone you contacted, you still came up to the same, it was in the same result. Tell us about some of the efforts you made to convince people, especially after you went and did this independent investigation practically.
Right. Okay.
With all that information, what was the response?
Well, listen, about a year before the Adam Walsh case was closed, this new detective took over, Chad Wagner. And the reason he took over the police department is because the former chief before him, he resigned because there was a scandal there. And what happened was the FBI heard that there was a lot of corruption at this police department. So they infiltrated the police department with an FBI agent. And the FBI agent acted as a kingpin for the mafia, as a capo, because the FBI heard that they were being drugs escorted from different locations by police cars. So anyways, they set up a sting operation, and they got these police officers to give police escorts for $38 an hour using uniform with their police cars from Port Everglades to warehouses. There were trucks filled with drugs. Well, not real drugs because this was just a sting operation. But anyway, so after a while, the police chief, his name was Scarberry, he leaked to his underlings that the FBI was onto them. And so all of a sudden the FBI, to protect their agent, had to call the sting operation off, and they raided the Hollywood Police Department. And four of them ended up in prison for long-term prison terms. And the agent said there would have been a lot more netted, you know, had the chief not leaked to his underlings about the sting operation. But anyway, this new police chief takes over. So I write to this new police chief, Chad Wagner, and I congratulate him on his new position and explain who I am, and I tell him I'd like to have an interview. But I never get an answer. So I start calling down there. Never get no response, answer machines, and nobody ever calls me back. I started going to other locations. File complaints. I went to the city hall complaints department. I filed a complaint against them, and I left them with a whole portfolio of information as well. And the woman I talked to, her name was Cheryl LeHown at the complaints department. She was very interested in what I was saying. She listened to me for like well over 40 minutes, and I gave her a portfolio, And she said she wanted me to come in and talk to the board there. They meet every Tuesday, she told me. And the board of commissions there, she said the mayor will be there. You need to tell the mayor this. So anyway, she never called me back. After about 10 days, I called her back. And all of a sudden, her attitude changed. She goes, well, if you have an issue with the Hollywood Police Department, you need to go to them to resolve your problems. So I said, well, listen, can I just get my portfolio back? She says, well, if you want your portfolio back, you have to go to the Hollywood Police Department to get it. I mean, her whole attitude was so obvious. Somebody put her in check, you know, and told her to just get rid of me. So I went to the sheriff's department. I wrote to Charlie Crist, the governor of Florida. And all these people were apparently calling the Hollywood Police Department and asking them what's going on, because all of a sudden, one of the detectives, his name is Lyle Bean, calls me up at home, and he goes, okay, I'm going to give you that meeting. I'm going, what meeting? Who is this? This is Detective Lyle Bean at the Hollywood Police Department. He says, oh, okay, so you want me to come in for a meeting? He says, yeah, come in Tuesday, 7 p.m., like that. So, yeah, well, I showed up, but I made sure I let people know where I was going to be at. And I met the police chief, and I asked him to make sure that this is going to be an amicable meeting, and he assured me it would be. And he left me there with these two detectives in a meeting room. And these detectives acted more like deceased Dahmer's unsolicited attorney than they did homicide investigators. They did everything they could to try and get rid of me as a witness. In fact, you know, for instance, when I was telling them about how I followed Dahmer, you know, they would say things like, well, what are you doing following somebody? And I know that mall better than you do. You couldn't have been at this point when he was at that point in the mall. You know, stuff like that, just trying to get rid of me. And you didn't actually see the abduction, so you can't even say it was Dahmer, was him. So, but anyway, finally, when none of that was working, they decided to use a threaten the witness tactic, you know, with arrest. So Lyle Bean jumps up, flailing his arms about, and he goes, you just admitted you were there. For all we know, you could have done it. How about if we arrest you? And then he backs up a couple steps, folds his arm like a tough guy, and with a smirk on his face, he says to me, so, you think you want to come back here again? In other words, take off, go away. We don't want to hear from any witnesses. So, yeah. And during that meeting, I even offered to take a polygraph test because I could see they weren't believing anything I was saying, but they were, but they were just trying to get rid of me. But I offered, and they said, well, polygraphs don't mean anything. They just mean you saw what you think you saw. And I was so incensed. After I left, I went and I self-sponsored my own polygraph exam that I paid $650 for. In fact, at first I went to a polygraph examiner in Hollywood that was supposed to be really well-renowned, but they told me that they do a lot of work for the Hollywood Police Department and that it would be a conflict of interest if they gave me one. So they wouldn't they do it. They refused. So I couldn't even get a polygraph test in the same town. So I had to go way south of Miami. I found somebody who had a good reputation, and he gave me the polygraph exam, which I passed with flying colors, which is good, like I said, because I paid $650 for it. And then he also, in his report, he had some not so good things to say about the Hollywood Police Department, because I did give him a portfolio to look over, you know, before I came back for the polygraph exam. So that exam is in the book, two pages, excerpt of it is in my book, as well as the on my website. So justiceforadam.com, you can read the polygraph exam there.
Absolutely.
But that's what these cops do. They don't want witnesses. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they go into full cover-up mode. And Milwaukee's doing the same thing. They cover up. You know, Dahmer's accredited for 17 murders in Milwaukee. Okay. Well, there's one murder that I believe Dahmer committed, that Dahmer was not credited for, and that's Dean Vaughn, who lived in apartment 308. That's one floor above Dahmer.
Yes.
Dahmer lived in 213 on the second floor. Okay?
Right.
Now, this murder occurred 4 months before Jeffrey Dahmer was captured. okay, when Edwards finally escaped, Tracy Edwards, he finally escaped from his apartment.
Right.
And it was at that time when the police messed up realized how bad they'd been messing up. Because a couple months before that, there was one kid that escaped. Dahmer had this 13-year-old Laotian boy, Conorak's phantom phone, and he was trying to make a zombie. That was one of his experiments. He was drilling holes in some of his victims' heads while they were still alive and injecting with a turkey basting needle watered down muriatic acid into the brain. Well, he thought his experiment was working with Conorak, so he left him home while he went out drinking. In the meantime, Conorak was naked, escaped from the apartment. He was wandering around aimlessly out in the street when these two young 17 and 18-year-old black girls saw him and called 911. The fire department shows up, and they're trying to give the young boy aid, and then the police department shows up. And the police chased the fire department away. They told them to take off. And then they told the two girls that, you know, well, at first they were talking to the two girls, and here comes Jeffrey Dahmer. And Dahmer sees what's going on here. So he goes up to the two police officers and says, hey, that's my friend. And he told the police officers, that's my 19-year-old lover. And they said, well, what's his name? And he goes, John. And then the girls are telling him, 19? He's not 19. Look at him. He's just a young little boy. Because, you know, he's Laotian, so, you know, they're not the largest people in the world. So the boy was, you know, looked younger than his real age. And the police gave him back to Jeffrey Dahmer. And Jeffrey Dahmer immediately executed him, cut his head off, and boiled it and kept the head as a trophy. Because when the girls were protesting, the police told them to take off or they're going to take them downtown, which means arrest them. So they forced the girls to take off, and the girls were insisting, and they almost arrested them. So finally, when Dahmer was captured, they realized what happened, and they were worried because all the black community as well as the gay community were out in huge numbers. I mean, hundreds of people in the streets, and they were afraid there were going to be riots. So they went into full cover-up mode. They didn't want anybody to know how many times they were in the Oxford building, all because of Jeffrey Dahmer, because of stink complaints, and open the homicide investigation of Dean Vaughn that was an ongoing for 4 months. In fact, when that Dean Vaughn was first found drugged, sodomized, and murdered on his bed with his pants pulled down to his ankles. Okay, they interviewed everybody in all 49 units of the Oxford building, knowing it had to be an inside job because that building has a locked door. So you need a key to get in, and if you're a visitor, you have to use the intercom system to be buzzed in. So they figured it had to be somebody. So they interviewed everybody, including Jeffrey Dahmer. But Dahmer claimed he didn't know Dean Vaughn, you know, and so after the case was closed, I called some of the residents that lived in that building, and they told me that, of course, Dahmer knew who Dean Vaughn was. They seen Dahmer going into his apartment, and they seen Dean Vaughn going into Dahmer's apartment periodically. So, of course, they knew each other. But the police are covering up. That is not one of his murders, and they never really grilled Dahmer on it after his capture, according to the Milwaukee police files. When they interviewed Dahmer about it, Dahmer simply said he didn't know the guy, and they let it go at that. That's all they did. So, you know, they never really pressed Dahmer on it. And they never tried. There's nothing anywhere that I could find where they tried to do any DNA matching to Jeffrey Dahmer because, you know, you can't commit a murder like that without leaving some kind of forensic evidence behind.
Right.
But there's nothing to show they did anything to try and see who really murdered Dean Vaughn. In fact, if you go to the Milwaukee police cold case files, even today, to check. Dean Vaughn is listed in their cold case files saying that if anybody has any information, please call the Milwaukee Police Department. That's all they have. Just put it in the cold case files, file it away, and put a little statement there asking for help when they don't even try to solve the case. Like I say, you know, a lot of these police departments, they're very good, but until they mess up. And then there's an old saying, when you mess up, never fess up. And that's what they do. Milwaukee does that. Miami does that. Miami does not want to make the connection to Adam Walsh. But I can tell you firsthand that Jeffrey Dahmer was there. You know, they say there's no coincidences in murder. So how is it possible for me, before Adam's even abducted, to have this encounter with somebody, follow him all the way to the toy department, because I get this feeling about this guy. He had this persona that you knew he was dangerous. But my thinking at the time, never in my mind in 1981 did I think a six-year-old kid was in danger. Never. I mean, what would a 20-year-old, Dahmer was 20 at the time in 1981. I was 34.
Right.
So I was thinking Dahmer was going to go up to somebody my age, or, you know, at least an adult, there would be words exchanged, a shoving match, maybe a fight. So I'm thinking maybe somebody might need help, or at least a witness at the very least. So that's the only reason I was following him. But when he didn't come out of the toy department, I'm thinking, oh, he must be playing the video games, and I just turned around and left and went home, because that is at the end of the mall, and my thinking was he's going to come back my way. I didn't want another encounter with him. So I left it, like I said, and it was that very evening I heard about it on the news. I knew. I always knew it had to be that guy. I just didn't know who he was until 1991 when I saw his mugshot, and I knew this was the guy. So now I had a name to put to that face. So how can you say it was anybody else, even if you don't think it was Dahmer or whoever you think it was? You have to believe that person I encountered has to be a suspect. You can't dismiss an encounter like that.
You showed every one of these witnesses, and you went to great efforts and found all these witnesses to put that incredible, what you call a witness timeline together that you put in your book, along with all the incredible, I got to mention this, all the incredible source documentation that you provide in this book, and the photos, incredible. But you talk about that you showed all of these people the composite, which I can say really does look like him when you take it into consideration how accurate it is. And that, we have to remind people that that composite was used at the other mall as well. So two groups of people seeing the same person, validating what you said when you saw it as well. And you showed those people, what you said was really convincing, was the 1981 mugshot.
Right.
Where Dahmer looked a little bit different than what some people might think.
Right. Because, like I say, that was the closest to the Adam Walsh abduction. It was only like 2 months after.
Right.
You know, from July 27th was the abduction. And then October 7th was that mugshot taken. So, yeah, all the witnesses recognize him. In fact, Timothy Pottenberg, who initiated the bolo on the blue van, because Timothy went there with his mother and his grandmother. They parked in the same area where Reve Walsh parked, by the north entrance. And they went into the mall and ended up all the way in the food court having lunch. Well, Marilyn, Timothy's mother, she didn't feel like walking all the way back to retrieve the blue van. So she asked her mother, or Timothy's grandmother, Carolyn Hudson, and Timothy, they went to get the blue van. And then we're going to drive it around to the east side food court so she could didn't have to walk so far. But on the way back to get the blue van, Timothy stopped in the toy department because it was right there by the north entrance in the corner there. And while he was in the toy department, he saw this man standing there pretending like he was looking at something, like a toy in his hand. And he just looked so disheveled and out of place And they eventually left and went out the north door. And when they stepped out the north door, the guy that, before they stepped out the north door, the guy ran out of the store. And a couple minutes later, they went out. But by that time, Dharma had retrieved the blue van. And when they stepped off the curb, he almost hit them. He almost ran over them. So Timothy ran around to the west side to see what the heck this guy's in such a rush for. And he saw the guy stop at the west side, jump out of the vehicle, run inside, and come back out with this kid and toss him into the blue van. And he told his grandmother, but, you know, they just didn't think that much of it and left. And, like, days later, when they heard about the abduction, they called the Hollywood Police Department. And it was Timothy that made one of the composites that were the spinning image of Jeffrey Dahmer, as well as the blue van, Bolo, that was first started from the Hollywood Mall. But they ended up dismissing him as well. Years later, after I got the case files in 2008, when they closed the case, I started tracking witnesses down, and one of them was Timothy Pottenberg, who lives in Central Florida now. So I went up, because a lot of these witnesses, I was able to track down their addresses, but not phone numbers, because a lot of people don't have landline phones anymore, and cell phones are much more difficult to track down. So I always do the next best thing. I just go to their house and knock on the door. And that's what I did. I went to his house in Central Florida, knocked on the door. He was sleeping. His wife was up. I explained to his wife why I wanted to speak to Timothy, and she got rousted him out of bed real quick. He came out, and we started talking, and Timothy told me that, remember, the case is already closed now. So Timothy told me he never did believe that Otis Toole's story, because Otis Toole didn't match the guy. He knew it had to be that right. guy he made the composite of. And he remembers that composite like it was yesterday. Yeah, and I showed him photos of Toole, and he scoffed at the notion that it could have been Toole. And I showed him yeah. mugshots and photos of Dahmer, and he swears they match his composite, and that's the guy he was trying to describe. He swears it was Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah.
The police don't want to hear him. They've never talked to him again. They refuse to talk to him or interview him. And that goes on and on and on. Vernon Jones was yeah. another one. Vernon Jones, listen to what Vernon Jones was one of the black boys that was in the toy department. Vernon Jones was staying with his grandfather, who was in the lawn care business. He lived in Hallandale. And he used to like to buy Craftsman tools. So he would go to the Hollywood Mall to look at tools. And one day he had Vernon with him. He was in the tool department. But at 9 years old, Vernon wasn't interested in tools. He was more interested in playing the new video games that were out, the Atari video games. So while his grandfather was shopping for tools, Vernon went over to the toy department. And he was playing this video game with Adam. It was an Atari baseball game. And there was this disheveled man standing about 15 feet away hissing at Vernon. He was saying, "Psst, psst, hey you. Come here," like that. Vernon kept trying to ignore him, but then Vernon looked up at him, and all of a sudden he heard this big crack because he wasn't able to concentrate on the game, and Adam had gotten a grand slam home run and beaten him. Vernon said he was so upset by losing to the younger boy, because he was 9, Adam was 6, that he just went around the other side and started playing Donkey Kong and left Adam there. And then a few minutes later, he saw that guy walking with this boy past his aisle. So you can put the timeline together. You know, as he was walking, Mia saw him standing, holding Adam by the hand, and then leaving with him. Vernon saw him passing his aisle. Philip Lohr then sees him going out the exit. Bill Bowen sees him in the parking lot. And then there's many other witnesses that are in between all of those. You have the full timeline of all the witnesses, and one that wasn't even there is their favorite scapegoat, the security guard. They pin this on her, saying that she kicked Adam out of the store. How does she kick Adam out of the store when all these witnesses see Adam being dragged out? and walked out. You know, he was walked out until he got close to the threshold. And then Adam was protesting as much as a six-year-old can protest. So Dharma picked him up and just carried him out at that point. And then once he got outside, Adam was squirming so much, he ended up just holding him up by that one arm up in the air, which Bill Bowen saw.
Absolutely.
So how is that that their suspect, Otis Toole, saw Adam out in the parking lot and gave him candy and talked him into getting his car? That's not even close to what the real witnesses are saying, the witnesses that were there.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a totally fabricated story that was made up by Detective Joe Matthews.
Yes.
Based on one witness. And this witness, who the police even had to threaten because he couldn't pass any polygraph test. They polygraphed him three times. He failed all three times. They sent him to talk to a psychiatrist to see if that would help. And the psychiatrist said he was incapable of working with the guy, you know, because he's the one that saw that episode of the white Cadillac that they did on that last episode of America's Most Wanted, of that John Morse did a show of his son, and they did a reenactment with the white Cadillac, Joe's reenactment. And, yeah, so he called, and he's the one that initiated that, them to do that white Cadillac thing, because he claimed he was there and saw this guy talking to Adam and getting a white Cadillac. But the problem with that is, in his statements, he was there at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then he went back because he went there to buy some camping gear because they went out into the Everglades to go camping. And then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he went back again to pick up a few more things that he forgot to pick up earlier. So in Joe Matthews' book, he writes that he was there at 3 o'clock and then he was there a couple hours earlier. Well, no, he was there 5 hours earlier. But Joe Matthews is trying to make it as close to 12 as he can to make it look like William Mitzler was there when Adam was abducted. But he wasn't even there when Adam was abducted, and that security guard wasn't there. Because according to Reveille Walsh's own statement and in Tears of Rage, this is what Reveille has to say. She left Adam in the toy department and went over to the lamp department. When she went back to retrieve Adam, he was gone, but the other boys were still there. So she was trying to ask all the other boys if they saw her son, but they were too busy playing the games to answer her. But finally, one Latin boy answered by pointing over to the west exit. Reveille says, the west exit is ridiculous. She came in the north entrance. Why would Adam go out the west exit, which is where all the other witnesses say they saw Adam being dragged out? So the kid was pointing in the right direction. But Reveille thought the kid was either trying to be polite to an adult, or he was Spanish and didn't understand what she was saying. So she couldn't find Adam. She ran out into the mall and ran up and down the mall a couple times looking for Adam, and then went back to the toy department. When she went back, all the kids were gone, which means what? It means Adam was kicked out before all the other kids were, went missing before the security guard went there and kicked all the kids out of the toy department. She kicked them out after Adam was already gone, while Reveille was out in the hallway, which means Adam was missing for 20 minutes, because I got the full timeline. Adam was missing for 20 minutes before the security guard even went there. In fact, some of the commotion that they say that there was could have been Adam protesting.
Yes.
Because Adam was screaming. He was the one that was screaming, and somebody called security.
Willis, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Frustrated Witness. We could go on for quite a while longer. For those that might want to and feel motivated to buy this book, Frustrated Witness, The Complete Story of the Adam Walsh Case and Police Misconduct, This is published on Book Baby, and I want to commend you on a very, very, very impressive package with all the source documentation and photos and just a fantastic looking like collectible book. Tell us how people can get your book and tell us one more time about the websites that you can that they could go to and visit.
Okay, again, I have two websites. Justice for Adam, where all the records could be found. Because in my book, I constantly reference where the information comes from in the records. So, you know, you double-check yourself the records by going to the website. Also, my other website where I have numerous videos, book trailers, other shows I've done, radio shows, interviews, at frustratedwitness.com. Also, you can link to my Facebook page from there, as well as other sites where you can buy the book. The problem is the site is not updated yet. So the book that's listed on my website, when you click on it, is the first edition that came out in 2015. But you can go to Amazon and just type in Frustrated Witness. You'll get the new copies of the second edition. There's two different books. One's a paperback and one's a hardcover. Now, the cover on the hardcover book, the crime scene tape I changed. The original book, 2015, says crime scene, your standard crime scene tape, crime scene, do not cross. But one of my attorneys told me every time she looks at that cover, because that's the room where Adam was murdered in with the blood spatter on the back wall, every time she looks at it, she thinks that it should say crime scene, do not investigate. So I changed the crime scene tape. So, and it also says second edition. Now, the paperback copy, I did a completely different book. On the paperback copy, I have Jeffrey Dahmer's mugshot on the front cover. So either one of those, you can buy the hardcover. The paperback's a little cheap. The paperback's going for about $32. The hardcover's about $38. Or if you want, you can go to the Apple bookstore. And I have the book listed there for only $9 and change at the Apple bookstore. So you can go there and download it if you have it, an Apple product.
Well, thank you very much, Willis. It's been an absolute pleasure. Frustrated Witness, the complete story of the Adam Walsh case and police misconduct. Thank you very much, Willis. You have a great evening. Good night.
And thank you for the platform. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good night.